Welcome to KRWG News This Week. I'm Anthony Myrtle. On this program, we take a look back at some of the top stories from the past week. Starting off, news broke this week that New Mexico U.S. Senator Ben Ray Lujan was recovering in an Albuquerque hospital after suffering a stroke. The senator is expected to make a full recovery. A senior aide to the senator said that he would be back at work in 4 to 6 weeks. Let's move on to our top news feature this week involving mental health. On January 24th, Dona Yana County reported that 386 inmates out of the 542 housed in the county detention center received some form of mental health treatment. Madison Staten visited the detention center to learn more about what that treatment looks like.
Within a remodeled block of the Dona Yana County Detention Center, Jason Duran and his team of mental health specialists are working to serve the 71% of inmates in need of care.
Many of our patients haven't received any care until they come here with us. That is why it's our mission to continue to provide the same level of care that anyone would receive.
45% of the individuals under the care of Duran's team of nine rely on a combination of medication and counseling. According to Horizon Health, the organization contracted through the county to provide mental health care. No individual is receiving medication for mental health needs without some form of counseling. The high number of individuals in need of mental health care while incarcerated is a trend seen across the United States. According to a U.S. Department of Justice report, 44% of jail inmates had some type of previously diagnosed mental health disorder, higher than the 37% seen in state and federal prisons. Horizon Health CEO Sarah Tershwell says the most challenging part of treating individuals within systems like the Dona Yana County Detention Center is that their mental health needs have largely been ignored prior to incarceration.
Why has a county jail in New Mexico become basically a de facto mental hospital? Why? Because we at some point decided that we were not going to provide a safety net for people and give them the mental health treatment that they need.
Duran says his team sees a lot of previous patients return to the detention center, despite efforts to connect individuals with resources. Micah Pearson, the executive director of the Southern New Mexico branch of the National Alliance on Mental Illness, is working with Dona Yana County to find solutions. In a longer conversation about mental health, Pearson told KRWG, NAMI Southern New Mexico is in the last stages of negotiation to provide peer navigation services.
My favorite program that we are working with the county to implement, which is peer navigation services, which are independent from any particular behavioral health provider, a team of folks who will go meet a client where they're at and figure out what do a needs assessment. We watch this person. We make sure they get from point A to point B. We see everything that's happening.
While there aren't enough resources at the county level to fund Pearson's entire proposal, he says the next step is looking for other funding sources.
Everybody says we need a thing, but nobody wants to pay for it. The county actually really does want to pay for it. They just don't have those funds. But, like, that's the thing. Everybody says it's important. Nobody really wants to put their name on the checkbook. And partly because that requires rethinking the system. And in some cases, you are taking money out of some budgets to put it into another.
Pearson notes that the city of Las Cruces could be one potential funding source, but that conversations still need to occur. And NAMI Southern New Mexico isn't the only entity working to enact change. Horizon Health says they are advocating this year to expand their Release with Care initiative nationwide, including expanding services offered in Dona Yana County.
What that initiative does is for addicted individuals, we give them 5 days, a 5-day supply of medication. Because when somebody leaves, they're not necessarily going to figure out everything that they need to figure out by the time they actually need that medication.
Above all, those like Jason Duran, who work at the Dona Yana County Detention Center, want the community to understand that while big change is needed to provide better mental health treatment nationwide, it's the small victories that mean the most to staff.
What drives me is knowing that the work that we do within the detention center does help to improve lives And it helps to improve those individuals that our other folks might forget about. When we have our small victories, it means a lot, because little small victories over time add up to huge accomplishments.
For KRWG Public Media, I'm Madison Staten.
Mental health was also the topic on this week's Newsmakers on KRWG TV. On the program this week, Madison Staten talked with Karina Diaz, who serves as program director at the Doñana County Crisis Triage Center, to learn more about trends and the center's day-to-day operations.
So are there specific mental health trends that you're seeing within the county that our viewers should be aware of?
Suicidal ideation. There's a lot of people who are under severe stress. We can say that a lot of it is COVID, working in a pandemic or living under in a pandemic, so isolated from a lot of the very important social connections that we had prior to COVID are definitely a factor. But even before then, that was an issue as well. There's lots of, sadly, drug use in our communities and not enough services that are, when I say quality services, I mean services that are appropriate to someone who is going through a crisis and might not even realize that they're going through a crisis. A lot of people that we see have come to the center quite a few times and definitely need the resources, but probably utilize the resources a few more times until they are able to see that there is a need to recover or that they can start that recovery process. Right? So when I say it's anytime, anywhere, no matter who you are, that you can access care and not have to go through a medical clearance, not have to be sent out for a COVID test so that you can come into our center, right? We're decreasing the barriers that exist for everyone.
So if an individual would like to take advantage of your resources but isn't sure where to start, what would be your advice to them?
I mean, they can definitely call us or just walk in and ask the questions. If sometimes walking in could be pretty intimidating, you can always call, reach out to us. We're open 24/7.
How does the center follow up with individuals after that initial first visit?
Yes. So we are able to provide crisis care for 23 hours. After that, we have to connect people to resources, of course, if whatever the resource that is needed or the next level of care that is appropriate for that individual. We do provide follow-up calls after 72 hours. We will reach out to providers who are involved with the individual. We'll reach out to whoever we have permission to speak to on behalf of the individual to make sure that they were able to get connected to the next level of care. A lot of what we do during our 23 hours is connecting them in person, if at all possible, to provide a warm transfer to the next community provider or their family members.
Well, I know there was an incident last fall where a person being brought in by the county sheriff was turned away due to lack of staffing. Mm-hmm. Have any similar instances occurred since then?
Yes, that was a very unfortunate time. We were, of course, brand new, and that's not an excuse, but we definitely have seen a shortage of nursing. We have since then addressed that, and that has not happened again, thankfully.
So how are we seeing national shortages of healthcare providers? How is that impacting the center?
Well, at this time, we've been pretty grateful to have a nursing manager who's been incredible in making sure that we're staffed continuously and that we have layers established with a nursing agency as well as a staffing agency, as well as our own pool of nurses who we can be able to call upon if need be. We've definitely seen the stress that has caused for ourselves, as the example you mentioned. At this point, it's been a blessing to have someone who's managed it so well.
So what is your current relationship with both city and county law enforcement today?
Well, we continue to have monthly meetings, especially with the Las Cruces Police Department. We have a stakeholders meeting that the county started last month, and we will continue to have that, I believe, quarterly, to be able to continue to work through issues, work through problems, work through the wrinkles, which in any new endeavor that's bound to happen, So we are continuing to augment our capacity to collaborate and coordinate.
So what protocols does law enforcement have to follow when they partner with the Crisis Triage Center?
Well, we have meetings. Protocols, I don't know that I would call them so formally, but they are able to bring in anyone at any time to our, we have an actual first responders entrance. So as soon as someone, an officer drops someone off, really and we track this, their stay at our center is like less than 3 minutes at this point. So all they have to say is, hi, I'm so-and-so, and this is so-and-so, and this is happening, and then I gotta go. And go out into the community and do what you need to do.
So what additional mental health investments do you think should be priorities for both the county and the city?
Mental health investments? I think, well, one of the things, and we talked about this just recently, the elimination of co-pays for behavioral health services was intended to remove any fiscal barrier for anyone to be able to utilize the center. I think that what is still missing is the parity, the insurance parity. I think that is a very important part. The county continues to advocate for this. We need to be able to have parity in all insurances so that everyone can have access and that the barriers are lessened to be able to access healthcare.
So how would you like to see the center continue to grow in the next 5 years, 10 years even?
Oh my goodness, that everyone, the community is aware, that the county is aware that we exist, that we speak two languages on site, English and Spanish, that we're able to access language line, that anyone who's experiencing any stress has a place that they can go, feel comfortable, talk to someone, and be able to be connected to care in the community. That we're consistently, not only in this state, nationally, talking, no matter where you are, about the lack of resources, especially in mental health, especially after this pandemic. And the likelihood of anxiety to have gone up and mental health illness as a result, the likelihood is high that a lot of us need this care, this quality of care. So for people to know that they can come and that it's free and that we're here for them.
So what would you identify as the key takeaway for our audience to understand about the center?
Yes. The key takeaways is that there's no shame in asking for help, that we are here to help, and that there will be no judgment whatsoever for anyone accessing care, that we, if you're over the age of 18, and even if you're under, if you come in with parents, we'll be able to talk to you and connect you to the right services. But if you're able to come in, if you're able to call, we will do everything in our power to be able to connect you to where you need to go next, to be able to ensure that there's treatment waiting for you after us, and that there's hope. Whatever it is that you're going through today, that there's a light at the end of the tunnel, and that people have lived through what you've lived through and have recovered, and that there is no shame in asking for help.
Well, according to the National Alliance on Mental Health, as of 2020, one in five U.S. adults experienced some form of mental illness. When you hear a statistic like that, what goes through your mind?
Well, it's very sad, right, to hear those statistics. I have definitely, before I moved to Las Cruces, I lived in New York and have been in the mental health field for 20 years. And I have definitely seen firsthand how much, not only in this state and New York and other states, the lack of access to resources, how much that impacts folks. And the lack of education that exists on how to access care and what therapeutic services are, what behavioral health services are, how they can help you. The lack of resources or the lack of education or the lack of understanding around behavioral health, I think contributes to a lot of these cases where the people who are experiencing mental health illness get ostracized by a lot of our communities, by a lot of family members, right? It's shameful to talk about it. There's a lot of judgment around it. There's a lot of biases, even within providers, around it, right? So it's a continuous effort on all of us, on providers, on law enforcement, on people from the community, in our own families, to be able to talk about openly if we're feeling sad, if we're feeling anxious, that we're not kind of looked down upon or looked at with judgment, so that we're then feel a sense of belonging and are able to then ask for help.
And how have you seen the pandemic influence this over the last few years?
It's exacerbated a lot of the mental illnesses. It's exacerbated the symptoms in the mental illnesses. It's exacerbated the propensity for us to feel anxiety in our surroundings and to feel unsafe, to feel a consistent source of not knowing what's going to happen next. So uncertainty, which then we may or may not feel it that we're going through it. But then there are certain interactions maybe with people or certain things that may have happened during the day. And then we feel the stress or maybe overreacting around certain things that maybe in the past we wouldn't have. We've become more isolated. Our social interactions have lessened. Right? So the support, the relational support isn't there. The COVID pandemic in and of itself, the fear of dying, the fear of someone you know dying or having known someone who died, the amount of grief that exists right now nationally and worldwide is definitely felt. So it's exacerbated a lot of the symptomatology of mental illness, sure.
So what specific additional steps would you like to see the state take to address this issue?
Yes, again, parity. We need for everyone to be able to access behavioral health services. A lot of times, and this is something I hear a lot, and not only in outside in the world, in the public, but with clients, but also with family members. A lot of times people do not access healthcare because it costs money, right? And you have to then see yourself make choices between paying rent or food and healthcare. I think that is the number one barrier for receiving mental health care.
That was Karina Diaz, Program Director for the Doñana County Crisis Triage Center. She was talking with Madison Staten on this week's Newsmakers. You can view their entire conversation in the Newsmakers section at our website, krwg.org. Monoclonal antibodies have been used as an effective tool against early-stage COVID-19. Dallas-based UT Southwestern Medical Center is now a part of a national trial testing polyclonal antibodies. Dr. Mamta John told KERA's Sam Baker it's an effort to keep more people out of the hospital.
Antibodies are what our body produces to fight infections. They're proteins that attach to particles, viruses, and direct our immune system to get rid of the pathogen.
How do the polyclonal antibodies that are being tested differ from the monoclonal antibodies currently used to treat COVID-19?
Monoclonal, mono meaning one, are targeted towards a specific area of the virus, the spike protein, because by targeting areas of the spike protein, we can block potentially the virus being able to enter the cell and prevent further damage. However, if there's a mutation in that area that the monoclonal antibody binds to, that monoclonal antibody wouldn't work. Now, polyclonal, poly meaning multiple antibodies, not targeted to one area of the virus, but multiple areas of the virus.
So is the idea here a stronger treatment or a more versatile treatment that can be used against more than one variant?
The idea is a more versatile treatment that potentially could be used against variants to treat COVID. Now, the thing is that we're still trying to understand if these polyclonal antibodies help in the early phases of infection. And that's why these clinical trials are being done. We've done the clinical trials with the monoclonal antibodies, and those do help in the early phases of infection. However, with Omicron, at least in the laboratory, it appears those cocktails are not going to be effective because where they bind, there's mutations there. And that's why right now there's only one monoclonal antibody that appears to be effective, sertralumab.
Appear to work against Omicron?
That's correct. But there's also a short supply of that. And so you could imagine that there may be scenarios where you have multiple different variants that are in circulation. In that type of situation where you might not know what's circulating, it might be useful to have a therapy like a polyclonal where it might not matter what variant you have because the polyclonal could work against all the different variants. And that's what is being tested right now. We're still trying to determine if these polyclonals are effective. And that's what these trials are trying to establish. And if they do establish that, that gives us another tool to use in the future if we have multiple variants circulating.
If it does prove to be very effective, the end result helps hospitals, doesn't it?
If we can give it to patients early in the course of illness, then the idea would be to prevent them from being ill enough that they have to go into the hospital. The idea is within the first 5 to 7 days, the virus is replicating. And you want to try to give an antiviral early to try to stop that replication.
The trials now are in phase 3, as I understand it.
When a trial is early on, they're first looking at safety. And when it's determined that they found the right dose, then it goes into a phase 3 to look at how efficacious is the product. It's found to show that it's effective, then it'll go to the FDA to be approved.
So are you looking for people to participate in the trials? If so, who? What type?
Adults who are in the early phase of infection. So they have symptoms within the first 5 to 7 days of onset. We are looking for people who are at high risk of being hospitalized. People who are older, people who are immunocompromised, people who are unvaccinated. We're trying to see if getting the treatment will prevent you from being hospitalized.
Dr. Montajan, thank you so much for being with me.
Thank you so much for having me.
That was Dr. Montajan talking with KERA's Sam Baker. Dr. John is a professor in UT Southwestern's Internal Medicine Department, specializing in infectious diseases. In more news in health, UT Health San Antonio is preparing to test an HIV vaccine that uses mRNA technology like the Pfizer and modern COVID vaccines. Texas Public Radio bioscience and medicine reporter Bonnie Petrie has more.
UT Health San Antonio infectious diseases doctor Barbara Taylor is leading the study, and she says the mRNA COVID vaccines are just the breakthrough HIV vaccine researchers have been waiting for.
It is really amazing to think of how all of our struggle over the last 2 years with COVID could actually lead to an effective HIV vaccine.
Taylor is looking for 15 healthy people between the ages of 18 and 49 to enroll in this phase 1 trial. The goal is to determine whether the shot is safe and whether it creates the kind of immune response that could ultimately protect a person from HIV infection. I'm Bunny Petrie in San Antonio.
In many rural parts of Texas, there are no hospitals and few, if any, emergency medical services. Texas Tech Public Media spent the past year examining the problem in the state. Reporter Jamie Lozano looks at some of the potential solutions to the state's healthcare drought.
We've got that holding up the sign, come move to Stanford. We'd love to have you. Houses are cheap. Cost of living is cheap.
James Decker is giving us a tour of Stanford, a small town in Jones County on the far outskirts of West Texas, where he is the mayor. Data from the American Public Media Research Lab shows that the town's population has been declining since 2000. He wants to reverse that trend, but there's a catch.
Asterisk. Internet's terrible, but we're working on it.
In 2018, Stanford suffered the loss of the Stanford Memorial Hospital, making it one of the 24 rural hospitals to close in Texas since 2005, according to APM data.
So historically, we've had a great healthcare system in Stanford. You know, that has kind of declined in the last 20 or so years, and partly that's a function of healthcare in general. The reimbursement rates dropped off. It just became a lot harder for doctors to make it in a rural community.
Decker was voted mayor of his hometown just a few months after the hospital closed. He says it shocked the community of 3,000 to lose it.
One thing to say, hey, we don't really have a great doctor in town. It's a whole other thing to say, you don't even have an ER now.
This is not a problem that we have developed. This is a problem that everybody has, and we're just one of the foremost victims.
Decker is right. APM data shows that Texas has the most hospital closures of any state, but the U.S. has had 135 rural hospitals close in the last decade. This has largely been due to financial problems, declining populations, and healthcare worker shortages. John Henderson is the CEO of the Texas Organization of Rural and Community Hospitals, or TORCH. He says there are several ways to avoid more closures, including new federal legislation.
It's called Rural Emergency Hospital, but rather than having inpatient services where you have overnight stays, it's built around the concept of having an emergency room and 23-hour observation.
Henderson says hospitals still have to pay overhead costs, such as paying the staff to be there and utilities, despite a lack of patients in many cases. And they still have to keep inpatient services open in order to receive federal funding. The new legislation would allow rural hospitals to focus instead on 24-hour emergency rooms and close inpatient services while still receiving federal funding. Henderson says one big key is Medicaid expansion in Texas. The government covers treatment and services to lower-income residents or those who can't afford it at all through Medicaid, and expanding it would cover more Texans, increase funds to hospitals, and increase the services provided. It could also help with the state's 21% uninsured rate.
It's 100% political. We continue to be a very conservative state. Medicaid expansion is part of the Affordable Care Act, but our statewide elected officials have, you know, been against that publicly for a decade now. What we show is Texas stands to gain like $4 billion and cover an additional million uninsured Texans if they would expand.
Henderson says there are other ways to get rural hospitals in stable condition.
So I think if you get a little bit of help from the federal and state, if you have some incentives for innovation around telehealth, if you have initiatives or grant-funded projects in rural Texas, all those things together add up to making, you know, a better outcome and story for all of rural Texas.
Project Echo is an organization in New Mexico that has found a lot of success through telehealth and has been able to help rural areas develop by creating a global network of healthcare providers to pass along information, treatment advice, and to collaborate.
Let's say we have a doctor in rural West Texas. He's a primary care physician. They can join an Echo program wherever it might be, and they can learn how to do that specific kind of screening or treatment or care in their own setting.
That's Ben Cloutier, Director of Communications for Project Echo.
So if, you know, that medical provider takes part in Echo and learns how to do that particular kind of treatment or care, their patients don't have to go anywhere.
Telemedicine is a solution Decker thought of for Stanford, and he's hoping to improve the town's broadband infrastructure to bridge the gap.
I think people are very open-minded, but that's you know, it's going to be difficult until you have reliable internet access.
So we can provide the same level of quality of minimum quality of life that you have throughout Texas.
Jones County joined the Technology Action Plan, a program being run by Connected Nation, a national nonprofit that helps to improve high-speed internet access. I'm Jamie Lozano in Lubbock.
Last year, Opal Lee wrote a children's book about Juneteenth. The activist is known as the grandmother of Juneteenth. She's championed it as a national holiday. KERA's Jerome Weeks reports a new children's book has been released about Opal Lee herself.
As one might expect, Opal Lee, who was interviewed for the book, is pleased with it.
I was just delighted to get it. I was thrilled.
And the portraits of her, painted for the book?
I thought they were really neat. I really did.
The book is called Opal Lee and What It Means to Be Free. Alice Faye Duncan wrote it, and Keturah A. Bobo created the artwork for it. She's a New York Times bestselling book illustrator. Opal Lee and What It Means to Be Free recounts the history of Juneteenth. It also delves into the painful history that inspired Lee. A white mob burned her family home in Fort Worth in 1939. But the 95-year-old Lee says what's most exciting to her are the people who created the book.
I just want more young people who have ideas to bring them out, share them with us.
Lee says she's humbled. by what young people are capable of doing for civil rights. I'm Jerome Weeks in Dallas.
Moving on to legislative news, this week New Mexico's House of Representatives passed a $1 billion increase in general fund spending that aims to strengthen health care for those living in poverty, boost teacher salaries, address environmental regulation and public safety in the state as well. I talked about this budget-focused legislative session with New Mexico State Representative Nathan Small on this week's Your Legislators. Joining us this week is New Mexico District 36 Democratic State Representative Nathan Small, who serves as Vice Chair of the House Appropriations and Finance Committee. Thank you so much for joining us, Representative Small.
Anthony, it's really a treat to get to be here, up here, but really feel like I'm back home there in the studio with you. So just thank you for this opportunity.
It's great to talk with you. Obviously, this is a budget-focused session, a 30-day session. I'd like to hear from you, since you're heavily involved in this process, serving on this committee. How are things looking right now? There's been a lot of talk and reporting about New Mexico having an excess amount of money and revenue this year. So what opportunities do you see that are really have a great chance of happening for folks in your district and the state of New Mexico?
Thank you so much, Anthony. This is a transformational time. This is a transformational moment, and we have to take advantage of it. What that means is that we're finally going to provide the pay for educators across the board that they need, that our kids and our families need. So we're looking at raising the starting pay for teachers to $50,000, level two at 60, level three at 70. And providing all of the supports, so teacher loan repayment options, scholarship options, funding the lottery scholarship as well as the opportunity scholarship, so that any New Mexican who wants to become or switch and switch careers and become a teacher or go through school and become a teacher can do so. We know that New Mexicans make incredible teachers, and so we're making, I think, a transformational commitment to our kids, to our families, to our educators, and education after this session will be a place that we look to for the opportunity and support that New Mexicans need.
Now, the teacher shortage has been widely reported across the state. The state has even called in the National Guard in some instances to help, fill the roles with the lack of substitutes and the teacher shortage. But, you know, when it comes to education, and you're talking about educators, there's really a lot of folks who are needed to fill many roles. So what do you think are some of the things that can really be addressed during this session to help fill those additional roles, you know, people that are working in the school library, people that are serving as custodians in the school districts? What are some of the things that you think are really going to help folks who don't really have a choice but to show up during the pandemic and serve in those roles?
You're totally right. These are folks who are and have been on the front lines. And so we're going to make sure that nobody who is in our education system receives less than $15 an hour in the budget that we just had the pleasure to pass with bipartisan support out of the Operations and Finance Committee. We're having, in addition to that $15 minimum within the for educators, there's a 7% average increase in pay so that we can both retain and recruit folks. And there's an additional 10% that's going into some of the positions, whether those are the supports within the classroom, on the different areas of support, whether that's speech language pathology or other things, school nurses, those sorts of folks who are critical in our schools, and never more so, as you point out, than during and continuing now as we fight to get out of the COVID-19 pandemic. So we have additional targeted raises for them. And I think what it all reflects is that this legislature is making a strong commitment, backed up by incredible and important increases in funding for that entire ecosystem for our public schools that we can be incredibly proud of, that is helped guided, you know, by families, by students, by kids, by educators saying, this is what we need. We want to fight for New Mexicans every single day, but here are the sorts of supports that we need. And in this, in House Bill 2 that we just passed out of House Appropriations, we have those multiple levels of increases, the supports on the back end as folks are wanting to come into the profession, the sort of training, the time when districts choose, it's completely optional, but when they choose to have extended learning or K-5 plus, that there's that additional time that teachers and educators have asked for to really make sure their preparation is there. And when you put this all together, I think we're finally getting into a place where we have the budget and we have so much feedback from New Mexicans all across the state about the needs, and to be in a position to help kind of bring those two together this session is something that is just so important, and I'm really excited that we're working on doing that.
Another issue tied to education funding was the issue of having access to broadband internet. Right. There are many students that don't have broadband at home, or they live in rural areas. You represent an area that is rural, and these are some of the challenges that folks face. So I'd like to hear from you. What do you think is going to be addressed during this session to expand and build that infrastructure and make sure it's up and running in case there are times where schools need to go back to remote learning?
Sure. Great question. And even as we transition out of remote learning, right, when kids are going home doing their homework over the weekends, you got to have access to broadband. Education is a core part. Economic development is another one. So we're building on progress that we made actually in the special session at the end of November into December. That's where we put over $100 million building on another very large investment in early 2021 that it is bringing well over $250 million to this challenge. Now, just throwing money isn't the only thing, right? So last session, we formed the Office of Broadband within the state so that there is one point of contact to help direct projects, to interface with the federal partners, because we know there are billions at the federal level that are going into this. We've finally gotten that person in place, and we've been able to start getting projects to go from kind of the conceptual phase to actual plans. And I think we'll start seeing deployment, including in Northern Doñana County, thanks to the strong work of our federal delegation led by Senator Heinrich, Senator Lujan. We're going to start to see ground being broken, conduit going in. We now have already, thanks to good local work, anytime roads are being done in the city of Las Cruces, and we're working on it with the county, getting that conduit in place so that it's much easier to go back in with fiber to support broadband. So what folks are going to see on the ground is actual improvements. Now, it's Doñana County, there are definitely parts that are incredibly rural that I'm very proud to represent. There are some parts of this state that are as rural as anywhere in the United States. And so it won't be overnight everywhere, but we're going to be seeing progress, including in Doñana County, that wouldn't have been possible without the investments and now this kind of support and the way to cohesively bring partners together.
Now, this is happening during a pandemic. I'd like to hear from you. What are your major concerns with COVID-19 in the district that you serve right now in Doñana County, in Northern Doñana County? And I'd like to hear from you. What are your concerns right now about getting addressed during this legislative session that can help folks during this pandemic?
You know, it's the fact that folks are still facing huge challenges, people getting sick, being hospitalized, people not being able to go into work, whether that's, in the schools or within healthcare facilities. Those are all huge challenges. And we can't fix everything, but I'm excited that folks are really working together in a few key areas. We've talked about in the education realm with full support that's going on there. In healthcare, we're going to be setting aside additional dollars, well over $15 million, that's going to go for hospitals and long-term care facilities to raise provider rates, along with huge investments in our Medicaid program This is going to help us have more healthcare professionals out there to support more healthcare professionals coming to Doña Ana County and really facing and dealing with the shortage we have now. There, within the nursing area specifically, we've seen incredible shortages back home across our state, across our country. That's why we're setting aside new money to go to NMSU and other higher education institutions to fund more nursing slots. So we're going to see immediate increases in pay, incredibly well-earned, much-needed increases in pay across the healthcare, the education realm for folks who have been on the front lines. And we're working to address at that higher education level, making sure that folks who want to attend either DACC or NMSU, especially in some of these healthcare and other really needed fields, teacher prep, that they're going to be able to do that debt-free. That's what we need as a state to move forward from this incredibly challenging time. I continue to be worried just by the basic health challenges, by folks who are sick, by folks who are facing challenges in family income. And so we're trying to work on all those areas. I think we're also, of course, you know, it's winter now, even though it's quite warm for this time of year, about to get cooler, get a little bit of moisture. We're also looking ahead to next year, what we expect to be one of the worst drought times for the state of New Mexico. So we've set aside our largest ever package of short-term drought response, while also supporting NMSU and a lot of their water technology work. And with the Office of the State Engineer, using general fund dollars to support their personnel so that for the sort of infrastructure upgrades that the irrigation districts and others want to do, that we're going to free up money for that. So, you know, it's really, there's no way to underestimate the challenges that we're facing. But as we're seeing with the budget and some of the work that's going on, informed by expertise from Southern New Mexico, I can't stress enough how great it is to hear from folks. You know, we had teachers that came up to visit. That's what's really driving some of these conversations and getting us into a place where we can make the sorts of not only dollar investments, but to do it in a specific way that support folks back home.
Now, when you're talking about New Mexico and its future, you've got to talk about economic development. I'd like to hear from you a little bit more about that. One of the things that you sponsored was a bill to help develop the hydrogen industry in New Mexico. Governor Michelle Lujan Grisham has voiced strong support for creating a hydrogen hub in the state. This already ran into some issues during its first committee hearing. I'd like to hear from you as somebody who is sponsoring this bill. Why do you think this is necessary for our state, and how do you see it being possible?
Sure. Hydrogen is all about decarbonizing our economy and growing our economy. We face a situation where our energy usage is only going to continue to increase, but we have to rapidly decrease the carbon intensity of that associated with that energy usage. So, you know, that's everything from, you know, more intensive energy uses in our homes, electrifying transportation, new manufacturing that's coming in, you know, supporting in our border region. The list is endless. We have to produce more energy at a lower carbon intensity, and at the same time, actually draw down emissions that have already been emitted into the atmosphere, because climate change is really an existential threat to all of us, no more so than in southern New Mexico. The reason I'm involved with hydrogen, the reason I've sponsored the Clean Fuels Act, as well as the Clean Future Act, we did the Energy Transition Act, it all fits into that same area where we have to produce more energy at lower carbon and build our economy at the same time. And hydrogen really fits into all of those areas at once. There are tremendous federal supports, connections to our higher education institutions, and real world applications on the ground. And so we're working to find the right sort of safeguards, really, to support what is going to be an industry that's already happening across the country and across the world. We want to carve out our place that's the cleanest and also the most supportive of innovation.
Well, environmentalists, though, have voiced strong concern against this, saying, questioning what's going to happen with that carbon that you do capture when it's stored in the ground, or it only takes specific rocks that you could really store it in. I mean, there's a lot of questions surrounding it. So I guess what makes New Mexico a safe bet with this process? Because there still seems to be some questions surrounding how do you store this carbon into the ground in a safe manner and a responsible manner.
Yeah, absolutely true. And it's an all of the above legislative strategy. This year, again, in the budget that we just passed, there's a 16% increase there for the New Mexico Environment Department, a 12% increase for our Energy, Minerals, and Natural Resources Department. Both of those are integral to that that safety, that health and safety framework that you just described, to ensure that we have the expertise on the ground, which I strongly believe with the budget that we're moving forward, we're giving ourselves that chance. We're giving ourselves the support to bring in the technical capacity and to work with the federal government on some of the areas like permitting for the Class 6 wells, the deep injection wells that are critical to carbon capture. The world has to do all of the above and to do it quickly. The more that we're on the front end of that, driving innovation, bringing jobs to Doñana County, making strategic investments, the more we're going to get more benefits, that is a cleaner environment, a better economy. The more behind the curve that we are, we're going to feel all of the consequences of climate change with really none of the benefits and the offsets. So we specifically within the hydrogen effort, we're working very hard to have the right sets of safeguards around carbon intensity to ensure that the energy produced is at the lowest carbon intensity possible, in line with what the federal standards are based on the bipartisan infrastructure law, and then to bring that support in for our environmental, our natural resource agencies, and to support our higher education institutions to get some of those key questions that you outline right, like around carbon capture. I want to really emphasize that for New Mexico, for our country, for the world, it's all of the above, decreasing emissions. But it's like a bathtub, right? You turning off the tap when the water's just about to go over the top of the bathtub, that's not sufficient. You have to take out that plug to draw down some of those emissions. This is one of the four key strategies for the world to deal with catastrophic climate change. And we're putting ourselves in a position to be a leader there, both with the hydrogen effort and also with the support and the vastly increased support for our natural resource agencies that we have in the budget now.
I guess another question is, how do you create these safeguards within the Environment Department? Because we're in the year where New Mexicans are going to vote on who's going to be governor for the next 4 years. You could have down the line a different administration, the possibility of that happening, and different funding going to the Environment Department. So how do you create sustainable monitors within this industry when you could have the change in executive happen and different budgets?
You work at all levels. And so within the legislation, we're working to put legal limits and safeguards in a very nuanced way, and that work is ongoing. It's the work we've done in a number of areas and past pieces of legislation that are really helping New Mexico. So you put it in the law. You do the work within the agencies that helps all New Mexicans. At the end of the day, the budget increases that we're proposing here, I think, will be sustainable as long as we keep revenue coming into the state. These are going to protect the health and safety of New Mexicans. And that's something I think most New Mexicans absolutely want, something that we can show in this really challenging moment with climate change. More renewable energy, more clean energy, less carbon intensity for the energy, electrifying everything, as Senator Heinrich says. Those are the sorts of things that as communities, as states, as economies do more of that, it's actually going to create more jobs.
That was New Mexico Democratic State Representative Nathan Small. You can view my entire conversation with Representative Small at our website, krwg.org, in the Your Legislators section. Let's move on now to commentary. With recent news that Supreme Court Justice Stephen Breyer will retire at the end of this term, President Joe Biden will have the opportunity to nominate someone to the nation's high court. It's a move that commentator Walt Rubel says is not above politics.
Las Cruces native Stephanie Valencia writes with pride about the role she played in helping Sonia Sotomayor become the first Latina confirmed to the U.S. Supreme Court. Valencia, who had worked for both the campaign and transition team for Barack Obama, was serving as his deputy director in the Office of Public Engagement when Supreme Court Justice David Souter announced his retirement in 2009. The broader impact of what her nomination means to the country became very clear and very personal. "I could be her," Valencia writes in the book West Wing. Getting her confirmed to the U.S. Senate became much more than just a political task. "It reminded me of why I had gotten into politics in the first place. Watching black women, especially attorneys, respond to the news last week that Stephen Breyer will retire at the end of this term and President Joe Biden will keep his campaign promise to fill the seat with a black woman has been uplifting. Some on the other side are responding with shock and alarm, alleging that Biden has politicized the process. Ronald Reagan was responding to a drop in the polls among female voters caused by his opposition to the Equal Rights Amendment when he nominated Sandra Day O'Connor to be the first woman on the court. Obama was being called the deporter-in-chief when he nominated Sotomayor. Donald Trump was trying to shore up support from women in the suburbs before the election when Amy Coney Barrett got the nod. Biden made his promise before the South Carolina primary, earning the game-changing endorsement of Representative James Clyburn. And thank goodness they all did. The bittersweet part of all of this has been watching Breyer's resignation, in both senses of that word. He's not only resigning his seat, but he seems to also have resigned himself to the fact that, yes, it really is all about politics. Politics isn't always a dirty word. In this case, it has forced long overdue change for the better. A group of Americans who had been excluded throughout the history of our court will finally be represented. But the political makeup of the court won't change. This summer, the court is likely to hand down rulings that will strip away women's reproductive rights, weaken state laws on concealed carry gun licenses, and require states to provide education funding to religious schools. And it won't stop there. One untimely death, combined with the political maneuvering of Senator Mitch McConnell, has resulted in a 6-3 majority for Republicans on the court. They will continue to hand down rulings that are out of step with the country until the majority demands change. Whatever that change is, it will come through the political process. With this week's commentary, I'm Walt Rubel.
Walt Rubel's opinions are his own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KRWG Public Media or NMSU. That's it for KRWG News this week. I'm Anthony Murnau. Thanks for being with us for the program. You can always keep updated with news anytime at our website, krwg.org. We're on social media as well. You can give us a thumbs up on Facebook, follow us on Twitter and Instagram, and also subscribe to the KRWG News YouTube channel to catch up on the latest local television episodes of Newsmakers and Your Legislators. Have a wonderful weekend.